This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Hugh Hefner founded Playboy magazine 50 years ago and remains its editor-in-chief. Among other commemorations, a 50th anniversary TV special will be shown on A&E this Sunday, but it's not the kind of show that does its viewers, or Playboy, any favors. Better to let Hefner speak for himself, which is exactly what he did when Terry interviewed him in 1999. In recent years, Playboy has been joined, and sometimes outflanked, by such next-generation men's magazines as Maxim. But when Playboy had the field more to itself in the 50s and 60s, it was, for a lot of men, the place to get aroused by centerfolds, to get advice on sexual positions, and the best positions for your stereo speakers, and a source of new short stories by the top writers of the day. To its feminist critics, Playboy epitomized a culture in which women were expected to be cute, naked, airbrushed, and airheaded. The Playboy philosophy may seem like a throwback to another era, but Hefner, now 77, hasn't given it up. In fact, when Terry talked to him 4 years ago, he had 4 girlfriends. Now he has 6. Terry phoned Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion and asked him what he thought Playboy magazine's greatest contributions were to the sexual revolution.
Well, Playboy from the very beginning has been a very personal magazine, and I think that it is a direct result of my response to my own Puritan upbringing. My parents were typically Midwestern Methodist Puritans, and our roots go all the way back to William Bradford and the Pilgrims. And I think that I saw things in growing up in my own home and in society around me that I felt were hurtful and hypocritical. And after World War II, I thought that things were going to change. I think to some extent I had a romantic notion of a time that I had missed in the Roaring Twenties, because I grew up during the Depression in the 1930s, and I expected the post-World War II period to be rather like the period after World War I, and it wasn't. And I think that I started Playboy in response to all of that, and I believe and hope that Playboy's played some small part in changing the values of social and sexual of our time.
Tell me more about the sexual standards you were brought up with. You described the background as being hypocritical sexually.
Well, hypocritical in the sense that, I mean, Puritanism by its nature is very hypocritical. There is a real denial of the reality of human sexuality, and I think that conflict, that unwillingness to deal with reality, is the essence of what most repression is all about and what Puritanism is all about.
Now, you worked briefly, I think, at Esquire magazine before starting Playboy. When you started Playboy, what was the initial emphasis? What did you think this magazine was going to be about?
Well, it was men's magazines in the period immediately after World War II were almost all outdoor-oriented. They were connected to some extent in the bonding, in the male bonding that came out of the war. And there was a great deal of emphasis on getting women back into the home. World War II had brought them out into the workplace, and there was everything from the government to TV to there were powerful forces urging women to return to the home. You know, the ideal kind of relationship, the togetherness that existed back then was mother and children in the home, father, the breadwinner, and spending time with other guys, you know, playing poker, bowling, hunting, fishing, things that had no real interest for me. And what I tried to create was a magazine for the indoor guy, but focus specifically on the single life. In other words, the period of bachelorhood before you settle down. And that magazine, or that concept for a magazine, was a revelation.
Were you a bachelor at the time?
I was coming out of a bad marriage.
So you were already a father by then?
I accepted all of the perceptions related to a full and happy and moral life before I began Playboy. In other words, I was anxious to get out of college. I actually doubled up because I was in the Army for 2 years during World War II and felt as if I'd fallen behind. And I went to the University of Illinois after I got out of the Army in 1946, and in part because the girl that I had met right after I graduated from high school was there, and doubled up my classes and finished college in 2.5 years because I wanted to get on with my life and felt that I had fallen behind. And we married almost immediately after I graduated. And so my expectations, even though I had no real game plan in terms of a job, my game plan was very typically conservative and typical of the time. Like almost all of my peers, I got married immediately after school.
How old were you when you lost your virginity? Was it before marriage?
No, as a matter of fact, it was typical. I lost it with the girl that I was planning on marrying, and after about 2.5 years of foreplay while we were in college, she was graduating, and we had sex shortly before we got married. We had sex right after, at the same time that she graduated from college, and I think that's typical. In other words, I had sex for the first time with the woman that I planned on marrying. The bad news is that she went off while I finished the last semester of college, and she went off to teach and promptly had an affair. And then confessed that affair a couple of months later, and that was the single most devastating experience of my life.
So you ended up not marrying this woman?
I went on and did marry that woman.
Oh, in spite of the affair, the relationship stayed together?
Yes. I think my reaction was to, far from being, I think the notion of ending the relationship, because that would have been unthinkable, but my reaction was actually almost the opposite. It was sort of like, wanting to put my arms around her and protect her, but it was a devastating experience for me.
My guest is Hugh Hefner, founder and editor-in-chief of Playboy magazine. The first issue of Playboy had a centerfold of the now famous photo of a naked Marilyn Monroe. How did you get that?
Well, I was looking for some kind of a gimmick for the first issue, and the first thing I came up with, as a matter of fact, 3D movies were very popular at the time. So I thought about actually putting a 3D pictorial in the magazine, and we actually shot it, as a matter of fact. Then I discovered that putting those 3D glasses in each issue would be very expensive and something I couldn't afford. And at the same time that I was going through that, I discovered that the already famous Marilyn Monroe calendar picture, which nobody up to that time had seen, was owned by the John Baumgarth Calendar Company out on the west side of Chicago, very close to where I grew up. So I got in my beat-up Chevy and drove out there and met with John Baumgarth and talked him into letting me publish it in the very first issue.
How much did you have to pay for it?
$500.
Oh, wow. Gosh, that's nothing.
And he threw in the color separations, and the color separations would have cost me over $1,000 by themselves.
Why did he give it to you so cheap?
Well, I think it was a very good and special day for me. I think that he saw in me perhaps a young entrepreneurial kid, some variation of himself at a younger time.
What about Marilyn Monroe? What was her reaction when you published it? And did you need to get her permission? Did you ask for her permission?
Well, we didn't need her permission. The photos were shot by Tom Kelly, and those in turn, or one of them in turn, was sold to the calendar company. But it was her reaction, of course, that changed everything, and indeed I think was very key to her own successful career thereafter. Her famous comment was, "I had nothing on but the radio," and that classic reaction in that very repressive time, because one must remember how really conservative the 50s were, for a major star to appear in the Altogether and to treat it in such a casual way with humor was a revelation and a very welcome one.
How did you come up with the concept of the Playboy Bunny? Was that yours?
Well, yes, because it was our trademark. In other words, originally the magazine was going to be called Stag Party, and fortunately that title was changed at the very last minute because I got a cease and desist from the lawyer of Stag Magazine that felt that it was an infringement.
Oh.
And I was originally going to use New Yorker, the New Yorker and Esquire were the magazines that most influenced me related to the creation of Playboy. Each of them had a male figure, Esky and Eustace Tilly. Eustace Tilly, the fellow with the lorgnette looking at the butterfly on the cover of the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted a male figure, but I figured that an animal would make more sense to separate myself from Esquire and the New Yorker. So originally it was going to be a stag, and it was a stag right up to just weeks before publication. As a matter of fact, the illustration with that first introduction that I wrote for the very first issue was a stag. And at the very last minute, we simply had the cartoonist draw a rabbit's head and paste it on top of the stag. So if you look very closely at that picture, the first rabbit actually has a stag's hoofs. So with the rabbit as our emblem, when we got to the point in 1960 of opening the first Playboy Club, my original notion was to have the girls called Playmates, but that would get a little confusing because those are the centerfolds. So one of our executives suggested the possibility of a bunny costume. We tried it out. I made some modifications, added the cuffs and the bow tie and collar, and the bunny was born.
What was your reaction when some feminists started to describe Playboy as exemplifying, you know, woman as sex object, woman as accessory, or the image that women's main function in the world is to give sexual pleasure to men?
Well, I think for a long time, I didn't have the language to respond to those accusations because, quite frankly, the women's movement, from my point of view, was part of the larger sexual revolution that Playboy had played such a large part in. So I really felt as if it was an attack from the rear. The enemy, it seemed to me, prior to that, was clearly the right wing and moral majority and the Puritan part of society. When it came from what was called the liberal left, specifically as a part of the women's movement, when the women's movement became anti-sexual, it was a very confusing time for me then. It isn't now.
Don't you think that some of the feminists then and now who had certain objections to a certain type of men's magazine were actually, that these women were actually pro-sex, but they thought that, you know, Playboy at the time and some other men's magazines had a kind of backwards idea of women, that sexuality was seen as something that that women weren't seen as equals to men, either in bed or out of it.
Yes, and I think that that point of view is understandable in the context of male-female relations historically. But the reality is that the major beneficiaries of the sexual revolution are women. It is women who have traditionally, historically, been given non-human roles, perceived as simply the daughters of Eve, perceived as either Madonna or whore. And I think that it is the sexual revolution that plays one part in female emancipation.
But I think the emancipation came far beyond, you know, women being seen as, say, a sex toy. It became women to define their own sexuality, use it independently as they pleased, and also be equals in the workplace and at home. And so.
Yes. Yes, all of that. And the notion that simply because they are perceived in some quarters as sexual objects does not necessarily deny any of that. We are sexual objects. At our best, that's part of who we are, but it's only a part of who we are. We want to be attractive to members of the opposite sex.
Hugh Hefner, the founder and editor-in-chief of Playboy magazine, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Hugh Hefner. Hefner is celebrating Playboy's 50th anniversary this month, along with his six girlfriends. But when Terry spoke with him in 1999, he only had four.
Well, now that you're single again, I've read you're involved with four women.
That's true.
And two of them are twins.
That's true.
They're 21. A third woman is 25, and the other is, I think, around 30?
No, the other's also 21. She's a classmate. The twins and the other girl, Jessica, are all college students.
Mm-hmm. So you're about 52 years older than they are.
It's true.
Does that make you feel younger because you're with younger women, or older because you're so much older than they are?
It makes me feel much younger. It's a real revitalization process. The connection with younger people and with younger girlfriends, without question, whether it's politically correct or not, definitely is a reconnection with youth. And I think at this stage of my life, much of what I'm doing is kind of a recapturing of my own boyhood and my adolescent dreams. I have, throughout most of my life, I've tried to stay connected as much as possible with the boy. The boy who dreamed those dreams is who I really am and always have been. And age, by and large, is for me, if you're healthy, is largely a number. It's just a point of view.
We hear something I sometimes wonder about couples in which there's a really big age disparity between them. Like, if you're 52 years older than the woman you're seeing, she in some way she couldn't possibly be your equal because you've lived, you know, a long time. You've been very successful. You've amassed a fortune and published this world-renowned magazine, whereas they're not even out of college yet. So, you know, it wouldn't be possible for them to function as your equal.
Is that of some importance?
Well, if I was the woman in the relationship, it would be important to me.
Well, I think, quite frankly, that people are attracted to one another for a variety of reasons. And, there's more than one kind of equality. In my relationship with women, that I'm seeing now, there's a very real equality in terms of, who makes the decisions in the relationship and what we do and how we spend our time, etc. But I would say that the relationships are more complementary than equal.
Mm-hmm.
Each of us brings something different to the relationship. I bring the experience and the years and the wisdom and whatever. And they bring a very special joy related to life that is not so sophisticated, not so cynical, and very refreshing.
Let me know if this is too personal, but when you have a relationship with a woman, how much of that relationship is solely about sex and how much of it is about, you know, a relationship about other things, sharing things in common, having, you know, intellectual interests to talk about or experiences to share and so on?
I don't think that you can have a good relationship with a woman if it isn't primarily connected to common interests. If you don't really like the person, sex isn't going to hold it together.
A lot of people would assume that the reason why your current lovers are so much younger is because they're so sexually attractive to you because of their youth.
True. But it is, as I said, something beyond simply sex. In other words, there's a romantic connection that has to do with my own childhood. I think that being a dreamer, a lot of my relationships are projections of dreams and needs and yearnings that come right out of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I stay very much connected to those dreams. And I have attempted in the last few years to reconnect as much as possible with the boy, and including, as a matter of fact, a lot of revisiting the films of my youth. And a lot of my friends now are people of whatever age who share those kind of boyhood joyous views on life.
What about the wisdom of the man, though?
What's that?
What about the wisdom of the man who's lived 73 years?
This is the wisdom of the man.
To go back to the boy.
You betcha.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me for asking this, but I know it's the kind of thing a lot of people wonder. Do you think that your girlfriends who are in their 20s are Do you think that what they find most attractive is, you know, your body or your fame and money and image?
I think they're most attracted to me because of who I am.
The whole package.
I think that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you know, some of it obviously has to do with money and power, but most of it I think is to do with the fame.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an attraction to who I am. And I don't have any problem with that because I spent a lot of time becoming who I am.
Right. No, it's funny. I was going through some old articles about you, and there was an article in Time magazine from February 14th, 1964, that had the headline, "Hugh Hefner Faces Middle Age."
Yes.
And so do you feel like you've spent a lot of your life trying to, like, lick the idea that you're growing old?
Well, I think that I've managed to spend the second half of my life successfully avoiding growing old. I think that all of us have to deal with the reality of our mortality, and I'm doing a little better job than most.